You're a bonus.
Okay. Thanks. It's actually wonderful to be back here again. It's always been terrifically productive for me to come here. And what I thought I would do is to show you some really recent experiments from our lab that are that we haven't really even begun in many cases to quantitatively analyze, but that have some kind of interesting physics behind them that might be worth thinking about. So the structures I'm going to talk about are neurofilaments. So I'll give you a brief introduction to what they are and what their supposed biologic role is, and then to show you some experiments that have been done recently, mostly by Oliver Wagner, a postdoc from Frankfurt, and Halima Aranda, who is a Santa Barbara trained theorist now doing experiments in our lab, and Philippe Carl in Dennis Disher's lab. And a lot of the biochemistry here was worked out by Jean-Francois Leterrier in Poitiers. In many cases, like this one, there's no way to proceed without the proper biochemistry to give you filaments that you can really rely on. So here's just a brief outline of what I try to do, and obviously I'm going to assume people will interrupt me, so I have no idea how far we'll get into this. So I want to give you a very brief biological context to give you some impression of what these filaments are thought to do biologically, and then to look at three different aspects of their kind of in vitro behavior. One is the flexibility of individual filaments like this, and the macroscopic elasticity of the networks that these things form, because they're very different from actin filament networks that we're more familiar with and other synthetic polymers. And the second aspect that we've been focusing a lot on is their electrostatic properties, because these things have a very, very high surface charge, and they're very interesting polyvalent counterion-driven condensation phenomena that these filaments undergo in vitro, and that may be actually very important for what they do in vivo. And one of these little phenomena that we can show in vitro is I think we have reasonably okay evidence that we're getting a pretty good charge reversal on these filaments by titrating them with the proper counterions. And all of this activity, all of this interesting biochemistry and biophysics of these filaments is pretty much mediated by structures that other cytoskeletal polymers don't have. So there are these long sidearms that emanate from the body of the filament that make these things look much more like polymer brushes and like simple polymers. So again, I'll just whip through the biology of what these filaments are doing. So these things are cytoskeletal polymers that are present only in neuronal cells and maybe one other cell type. And they're specifically enriched. Is there a pointer here? Or a stick or something. I suppose it doesn't matter. They're specifically enriched in the very long processes that come out of neuronal cells. To make a long story short, the interesting structural aspects of neurons is that they have small cell bodies that synthesize all the proteins, and they have extremely long extensions. So, you know, the cartoon image is that to move your toe, your toe muscles are operated by a single nerve cell whose cell body is in your spinal cord, and these little guys course all the way through to the meter distance that it takes to operate your foot. So they have enormously long lengths, and these processes, the small ones are called dendrites, the large one is called an axon. These things are full of neurofilaments, and that's the predominant cytoskeletal element in them. And in particular, we're interested in the stuff in these very, very long protrusions.
Can you tell us what structure is in that?
Yeah, as far as we can tell, I guess that's in a couple of slides ahead. In fact, that's the cartoon. Oh, fabulous. Thank you so much. I wanted to get you to add into this PowerPoint file a really nice image taken from a textbook, and that's what crashed my computer. So you won't get to see that until I figure out how to resurrect my computer. This is a kind of structure of these cells, just grown in vitro, small cell bodies. This is just grown on a tissue culture dish. So rather small cell bodies, and these very, very long processes. So the length scale here is probably 100 microns across, and these things are often smaller than the diffraction-limited image we can get. So they're on the order of a few hundred nanometers to a few microns in diameter, but they're many, many tens or hundreds of microns long. And
so you can just grow these neural cells on the glass substrate.
It's actually not so simple. These are notoriously nasty cells to grow because they will not grow on glass surfaces, even if you give them the right chemical environment. That in the body, in the brain, they grow surrounded by other cells called glial cells or astrocytes. And one of the other projects that we've been working with in the lab is to exploit this finding that you can grow these cells on a pure surface as long as that surface is soft. So this is something that's really complicated, the field of trying to grow neuronal networks on semiconductor surfaces, because it just won't grow on this stuff unless you really mess around with it. They don't want to make tight contact with something rigid. And usually they grow, so these cells are growing on top of a layer of cells that we don't see that are happy to grow on glass. But these guys are growing on the backs of another cell layer on top of these so-called glial cells. And it turns out that they need some chemicals that these other cells are spitting out, but they don't actually need to touch them. And it's been thought that they actually need to make physical contact with these cells, but that seems not to be true. They need to make physical contact with something that's soft. And soft here means a couple hundred pascal. A couple thousand pascal is already too stiff for them to grow on. So one of the interests in our labs, it turns out that all kinds of cells have a very strong preference for the mechanics of the materials that they grow on. And some cells like hard stuff, some things will die if you put them on something soft. And neuronal cells are the other way around. They love things that are soft, and they dislike things that are hard. And it makes sense in a way because the elastic modulus of the brain, for example, is very low. It's a couple hundred pascal at the most. The elastic properties of a blood clot or your soft tissue is more in the sort of tens of thousands of pascal. And the brain is very soft, even though these cells are just loaded with this dense meshwork of polymers. And the appearance is somewhat misleading because the polymers are surprisingly soft. Here's an example of what I just mentioned, that instead of growing them on a glass surface on top of other cells, you can grow them on a 200 pascal gel that's been laminated with the right adhesion molecules that they want to sit on, and then they're happy to sit on the surface. No other cells around them are touching them. Single cell, and it's extending these processes that are many tens or hundreds of microns long. Yeah.
Are there relatives in these filaments in other cells, or are they all in neural cells?
No, there are, almost all cells have some form of intermediate filament. And I don't know if this next slide has a cartoon. No, it's something that crashed. Come on. Oh, let's let this sit again. But so all cells have a class of intermediate filaments that are made out of proteins that are a large number of proteins. So there's basically only one kind of actin, and there's two or maybe three kinds of tubulin. So those filaments are pretty simple chemically. But intermediate filaments are different in that different cell types, all cells have some kind of form of self-assembling helical coiled polymers that make these intermediate filaments. But different cell types have different variants, and those different variants have been given very different names. So, you know, skin cells have keratins, soft tissues have vimentin, muscles have desmin, neurofilaments have a bunch of different things. Neurons have neurofilaments, they have other things called filensins, and there's a whole complicated zoo of names. But what all of these polymers have in common is about a 10 to 12 nanometer cylindrical core that's preserved in all of these kinds of different proteins. And what differs is the polypeptide sequences that kind of emanate or decorate these cores. But the physical properties of these intermediate filaments seem pretty similar to each other. I mean, the bending modulus of any intermediate filament is pretty similar. What's different is how they interact with each other and with other polymers and so forth. So all cells have them, but different cell types, their intermediate filaments are called different names. And neurofilaments are just a type of intermediate filament that only neuronal cells make. And there's one unique difference. So here's an electron micrograph of, I guess what Fred asked me, that inside this axon, if you stripped off the membrane and made an electron micrograph, this is from a paper from Hirakawa, that volume is densely packed full of all kinds of polymers. There are a couple of microtubules, they're these fat things, on which, you know, organelles run and so forth. But most of the mass of this material is full of intermediate filaments. So all of these small, thinner polymers that make many, many cross bridges from one to another, from themselves to microtubule, and these are mitochondria. Some of these are mitochondria, some of them are vesicles, but they also have many little wispy branches that hold them together. But most of the mass in here is neuronal intermediate filaments. There's almost no actin in these guys. There is a little bit of actin, but it's all on the membrane surface as far, and occasionally a filament, but it's a very small volume fraction of the polymers. Most of the stuff is these intermediate filaments. And so, this I guess is an experiment done by Helene. So what we have started to do is to look more quantitatively at the structures and the flexibility of these intermediate filaments. And so here's,
sure.
Both. The way they were originally defined is from people who did electron micrographs of muscles. And so the word intermediate comes from they found in electron micrographs thick fibers, which turn out to be your myosin filaments, thin fibers, which turn out to be actin filaments, and then filaments which they didn't understand, but they were intermediate in size, so they just called them intermediate filaments before anybody knew anything about their chemical composition. And nowadays, I think it's easier to think that intermediate means intermediate between an actin filament and microtubule, which is correct, but that's not where the word came from. But that word has stuck because it turns out that all of these 12 nanometer diameter filaments are composed of a very large family of genes, but all of the genes code for proteins that are slightly similar in their central part, the part that you need for polymerizing into the filament, and very different in other parts. So the accessories are very different, but the fundamental body of the polymer is the same, or at least similar. So that's where the word came from, and it's basically just, you know, turned out to be a matter of luck or coincidence that all of these intermediate filaments have the same polypeptide sequence, but they're very, very different one from another than, for example, actin from a fish and actin from yeast, or, you know, those actins are basically all identical. But an intermediate filament from a fish, is the polypeptide sequence is very different from an intermediate filament from a human, even though those polymers can copolymerize and they share some things in common.
They're about double the diameter in general, but an order of magnitude more flexible.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, that's one of the really interesting things that I think hasn't been. I know that Eric, in your paper on the Desmond I guess it's Desmond or keratin intermediate filaments, you make this point that they're so flexible it's known that there are, I think, 16 or 30, there's 16 alpha helical coiled coils in cross section in this cylinder, and it's pretty well known what the bending modulus of an alpha helical coiled coil is. So if you just add up, you know, 16 of those coiled coils as though they weren't connected with each other, that number is still about slightly bigger than the experimentally measured bending modulus of these intermediate filaments. So they're enormously soft.
And if you were to connect them all,
yeah. Go way up. Yeah. So where it's a mystery of why they are so soft. There's some kind of interesting packing irregularity that is present in the unstrained state. And one of the things that we've been working on is why these filaments get enormously stiffer as you pull on them. And one possibility is that as you pull on the filament, some kind of ordering or connections between these alpha helical coiled coil sets in, and now you get something that looks like a tie together bundle. But they're very poorly worked out, and partly because they're so unstructured that things like X-ray scattering from these filaments has been extremely unhelpful to tell you anything about packing distances or order. Everything that's known mostly comes from electron micrographs.
Although they do generally have a sort of hierarchical chemistry, right?
Yeah.
The shorter segments, once,
Yeah.
That then tumble further.
Yeah, I think yeah. When I skip on to what the, okay, so maybe this will make that point. So all intermediate filaments have in common a polypeptide sequence of about 50,000 molecular weight that is mostly predicted to be alpha helical, and two of these. So this is a single polypeptide, and two of these polypeptides will make an anti-parallel coil with each other to make a little dimer. And those two dimers will associate into a symmetric tetramer. And it's that symmetric tetramer that you can make under some conditions be soluble that you can grow into a filament. So people think that the building block is this symmetric tetramer, and that those things pack into this kind of bundled array, so that in the end you're left with about, I think 32 altogether alpha helices per cross section of the filament. But the way that those things are held together is poorly understood. It's basically only guessed at, because if you look at the charge sequence of the alpha helical coil, there's positive, negative domains, and one can guess that those are staggered somehow. So there are, I think that's my understanding, is that that's about as much as is really clearly known. But in the hydrated filament, they're very unstructured. And what makes neurofilaments different from these other guys is that they have a polypeptide coming out of the C-terminus of this, you know, filament-forming part that is bigger than the polymer subunit itself. Most intermediate filaments are just this red part with little things on the two ends. And neuronal filaments are unique in that they have this long extension called a sidearm, which I'll concentrate on in a little bit. Okay, so be clear. And the thing that is, so let's back to the sort of the pre-molecular picture of what these guys look like. They are surprisingly flexible. So this is 500 nanometers length scale. This is an atomic force micrograph of now a fully hydrated neurofilament that's just been layered down onto a mica surface. So it's probably distorted by the charge interactions with the mica, but it doesn't seem to be radically distorted. And we're just beginning to now trace these contours and see what we get for a persistence length from this. The best estimate that we have of this, of the persistence length, at least being less than a micron, comes from some analysis of Klaus Kroy from dynamic light scattering measurements that give us this number. And that number seems to be very similar for neuronal filaments as well as for vimentin intermediate filaments. So the persistence length is definitely less than a micron from scattering measurements, and it's probably consistent with what we see here. So this is at least an order of magnitude lower than it is for actin, and probably three orders of magnitude less than it is for microtubule. And another thing to just to point out, because it'll be relevant later, is that the other thing that complicates neurofilaments is that they have three different polypeptides that make the filament. They have a so-called heavy chain, medium chain, and light chain. The light chain, and all three of those subunits co-polymerize with each other in the filament. So the light, everything has the conserved red part, and heavy, medium, and light differ by how big this extension is. So this part doesn't form part of the polymer. It just sort of goes out somewhere. And it's that going out somewhere that seems to be really interesting to play with. Okay. So the other thing that they have in common is that all the subunits are very strongly anionic, and they are tremendously highly phosphorylated in the cell. So I'll get back to that in a moment. But if you just count up the excess negative charge that's fixed on the polymer surface, a neuronal filament has a surface charge density of about somewhere between 1.5 and 3 charges per square nanometer. So this is bigger than, maybe 2 or 3 times bigger than, the surface charge density of DNA. So it's a very highly charged polyelectrolyte, even if we just smear the charge over the whole cylinder. And that charge can go from, the reason there's such a big range is that if you take, this is the number for a filament where we don't have any phosphate groups put them on, And this is the upper limit of what happens if we take all known phosphorylatable groups and think that the cell has phosphorylated them. And the kinds of things that we're purifying from the spinal cord of cows, which is where these come from, they're pretty much high phosphorylated. So probably up on this high end of charge density. Well, they're very stable to depolymerization. So we can put them in low ionic strength buffers and high ionic strength buffers, and they won't depolymerize, which is very nice compared to actin or microtubules, where you have to do things to them to prevent that. But they are very sensitive, and this is something we're just sort of exploring, that their structures depend a lot on not so much the monovalent ions, but divalent and multivalent ions get these things to do all kinds of interesting stuff. And I'll get to that in a moment. And partly, as you can imagine, that multivalents get these things to collapse into little bundles or rings or so forth. But you'll see that we can also get them to redissolve. So I want to just... Sorry. It's because for a biological polymer, this is a low persistence length. For a protein filament, this is a low persistence length. Compared to, DNA or synthetic, this is very stiff. But for a biological thing, it's pretty soft, and it's much softer than other cytoskeletal polymers. And the gels that these things form are probably no more than, even in the axon, that densely packed thing, that the volume fraction of the polymer is probably never more than 1%. Maybe it's 2% somewhere, but it's a very low volume fraction of gels. So from a biological standpoint, they're soft. And I just wanted to show you two things. That one is kind of an old, sorry? Please, yes. This is the flexible chain is always, at least these pictures are always taken in ionic conditions where the surface charge is very high and negative. So, or actually charge reverse, they also look like this. But we can't really tune the surface charge very much in any way we can control, because they soon start to aggregate, so we don't see anything but tangled up junk. And we're also a little bit at a disadvantage compared to imaging things like actin filaments or microtubules, because if you try to image these things not on a surface but just in three dimensions by light microscopy, you see, unless you put a flow on it to elongate it, you just see this kind of balled up fuzz of fluorescence. So we can't resolve the contours when they're in 3D, but we can when they're on a surface. The hairs. Yes, I'll get to those in a second. Yeah, we have no idea. We're really puzzling with these things. These things are always charged up under the conditions that we're doing these experiments, as far as we can tell. But even bigger. But sometimes bigger. I'll get to that in a slide or two. But much of the charge is carried by these things which are sticking out. So in a way, it's a little bit like the proteoglycans in the cartilage, but not quite so extreme, if that's familiar to you. But from what we used to be mostly kind of flogging is the nonlinear elasticity of these networks, because it's quite interesting. And they're tremendously strain hardening, but in a way that's different for actin. So in a generic way, here's an old slide that just to remind you of what this elasticity at large strains looks like. If we look at the relative elastic modulus, so we've just normalized by the elastic modulus in the very small strain limit of three different polymers, so F actin networks that are in this case cross-linked by filament, polyacrylamide gel, so standard flexible hydrogel, and in this case vimentin intermediate filaments, but it could just as well be neuronal things. They have this peculiar feature that, for actin, it's been known for a while that at relatively small strains, 5 or 10%, they begin to stiffen up the networks as you deform them, but then they break. And this is something, actually, at the moment that Kay Storm, a postdoc who's been working with Tom Lubensky and me, is trying to model this in a kind of a network setting. And but whereas something like a flexible polymer with lots of excess contour between the cross links is just linear as can be over this whole giant range. And intermediate filaments are sort of different. They don't stiffen up until they experience a pretty big macroscopic strain, 25-50%, and then they stiffen up in a hurry. And this is perfectly reversible. So you can strain these things to 100% in a, at least in a shear deformation, and they recover. They're perfectly fine. It just shows you the no filaments are basically doing the same thing. But one of the things we've been trying to one of the things that I one of the slides I that disappeared when it crashed is it's going down because we've broken something. We don't know what we're breaking. So we can strain them to 100-150%, but we can't strain them past 200%. And then something lets go. And it's either the connections between the neurofilaments or the neurofilament body itself. We don't really have much of a way of looking at it. But here in absolute numbers, this is for about a 0.4% volume fraction gel. So this is close to, but probably a factor of 2 or 3 lower than the physiologically relevant concentration. So they can explore this whole area between 10 and 100 or so pascal of stiffness. But this is a much smaller number than we would get if we made 4 milligrams per mil of cross-linked actin. That would be 10 times stiffer, probably. I wish I knew. There are no known protein linkers like there are for actin. So there isn't anything like filamin for actin. There's no counterpart for neuronal filaments. The thought is that these sidearms that emanate out from the body, they are themselves the linkers. But that linkage strength is tremendously sensitive to divalent ion concentration. So the slide I wanted to show you but didn't shows that this elastic modulus, so this whole feature of strain hardening and the whole magnitudes are shifted up in a kind of interesting way as we titrate in magnesium ions. So the more, as we put in somewhere in this 1 to 50 millimolar magnesium ion range, the networks form faster as they assemble, and they form tighter networks. And the only thing we're messing with is magnesium, and there's nothing special about magnesium either. If we did it with cobalt hexamine, we'd get the same effect. So the association between the filaments seems to be very much counter ion dependent. I don't know. It's a good thought. I don't know. I think we've not looked at that. Yeah. I don't think so, because I think we're putting in sort of big shear fracture planes and stuff that have to recover. So I don't know. It recovers slowly. That's all I remember. One thing actually that maybe we can talk about later this week is we have some very recent experiments that Jay Tang is also did when he was still in the lab, that it turns out that if you take actin filaments that are cross-linked with filamin, they recover really fast after this breakage. So it's there, it seems as though the cross-link is letting go, and you just have to find another cross-link. If you artificially and sort of almost covalently link them together with biotin avidin, so a link that's much less dynamic, then when they break, they never recover. So we don't know from this, but I think that may just be for a technical reason. Maybe we can find some way to figure that out.
Sure.
Yeah, there is. There is quite a bit of a rate dependence. Well, the low strain modulus is relatively frequency independent. So we're in some kind of, at least over the range of, you know, a tenth to 50 radio hertz or so that we can explore, we seem to be in some broad plateau. But these things are always creeping. So when if we do these strain measurements at a low frequency, especially at high strains, we definitely get smaller numbers than if we do them at you know, high frequencies. And if we do something like a stress relaxation, the stress decays much faster if we strain it a lot than a little. But there's a lot of complicated rate nastiness that we haven't worked out yet.
Well, one more question. Yes. If you translate that your plateau modulus, or actually your modulus, into an entanglement molecular weight with the river elasticity, do you know
it is. Oh God. I did that and I can't remember the number. Oh geez, I should know and I don't. Sorry. I think it's too small. Yeah. Well, yeah. Oh, I think it's a fraction. Well, I think so. Yeah. I think that's right. I may be confusing it with actin. That's true with actin, but we may have to take another look at it. Okay, so let's onto these sidearms. So one of the things that's been confusing a little bit is that from electron micrographs of dehydrated filaments, occasionally you can get images that look kind of like what's shown in this cartoonish picture. So here you have this 12 nanometer cylinder, and every 22 nanometers, so it's almost in scale, every 22 nanometers, some long unstructured polypeptide comes out. So that's the sidearm. And the sidearm, under the best conditions, where the things where the filaments are really splattered on a surface, these things can be 90 nanometers out from the center of the filament axis. So they can be tremendously far out compared to the cylinder itself. And we've been struggling to see these structures, which are only like 1 or 2 nanometers in diameter. So we cannot in our AFM system in a hydrated chamber convincingly see these things. We think they're there, and we've also been searching for this mass by neutron scattering to see if we can find conditions that kind of tune how far out these arms go. But that's been done by electron microscopy in dehydrated samples, but so far we haven't really seen it in hydrated samples. But we're trying. I think not. We were trying to collaborate with someone at the NIH who's doing this cryo-electron microscopy. I don't know if they're. Yeah, in vitreous ice. I think. As far as I know, it's never been tried. There may be enough contrast. I mean, it's such a thin, wispy sidearm that comes out. It may be visible, but it might be. It would be a wonderful thing to try if we just haven't hooked up with the right people to actually give it a try. It seems like something that ought to be there. So what we've done instead, a little bit, is to Leterrier has a very nice biochemical way of clipping off the sidearm from the heavy chain, and this is just a electron or like a SDS gel to show you that we can make a purified purified heavy chain sidearm that came from this. And everything else gets digested away. This is one of those instances where you cannot use molecular biology to help you, because this polypeptide sequence expressed in any kind of artificial system comes out as an insoluble glob of stuff. So the only way to get it is to take an intact filament and digest it away. So I'll show you a couple of things with that. So again, just to remind you that these hairs, which you can maybe make out in this electron micrograph done by Leterrier, kind of it makes it look quite a lot like a sort of a kind of a comb-like polymer, and that analysis of these things suggests that these things are anywhere between 20 and 90 nanometers in length in different preparations, and their length depends on the ionic conditions of the preparation and the extent that these things are phosphorylated. At least that's the claim. And one of the reasons that's supposed to be biologic, sorry. It's not known. There's not enough resolution to know whether it's like an accordion that gets pulled in or like something that just bends back on itself. I think that's not known, and that's one of the things we're trying to test. But I think it's the images aren't really clear enough to to tell. And it's an unfortunate thing, they're so small. But this is Helene's thought that sort of resonates with what the biological people think these neurofilaments are good for. So the idea is not that they're making a viscoelastic network the way that actin would, because in most micrographs of the axon, the filaments are all parallel to each other. There's very few of these filaments going transverse or making anything that looks like a network. But the thought is that what they're doing is they're just filling up the space. They're sort of ballooning out the axon. And it's kind of a plausible thought because the axon, a typical myelinated axon diameter is about 6 microns. And people know from microscopy exactly how many microtubules and how many neurofilaments there are. Actin filaments are scarce and they're mostly confined to the submembrane surface. So there's 115 microtubules and 2,000 neurofilaments in a typical thing like this. And if you, so the volume, the cross-sectional volume that the microtubules occupy, if they were close packed, is pretty small. So that's not filling up the volume. Same with the neurofilaments. If you just count all of them up and just think that they have a 12 nanometer diameter and hexagonally close pack them, you also get a small thing. But if you allow these arms to come out and then guess, okay, the volume that's occupied by these filaments includes the volume swept out by these charged, hydrated arms, then you get a very big volume. So here's the equivalent volume. So here's the volume of the axon, the cross-section of the axon. This is backwards. If they're dephosphorylated, they're slightly smaller. If they're phosphorylated, they're bigger. So the one thought is that you can sort of tune the pressure or the amount of volume or something about the axon simply by playing around with this phospho-dephospho state. And let me see if I can. I think I have the picture I was going to show you, but let's get on to the sidearm. So the sidearm is what's supposed to be doing this. And here's what the charge of the sidearm looks like. So if you cut this thing off and look at the polypeptide sequence of NFH itself, just the heaviest chain. So this is the only one we can biochemically make. Negative charges are red and positive charges are blue, and these green things are places that can conceivably be phosphorylated, so to become very negative. So this may not, I'll show you another graph which will make more sense in a moment. But the interesting thing is that even though the large majority of these amino acids are charged, which is very rare for a protein. They're very unusual sequences to have something this full of plus and minus charge groups. But the net charge is almost neutral. But if you phosphorylate it, it's enormously big. And if you look at where the charges are distributed, that's also kind of interesting. So here's a plot of the net charge per, I think, 30 amino acid hunks every once in a while, starting from the N-terminus. So this is all the filament-forming part. And this is all the non-filament-forming part that sticks out. So just after so the filament-forming part itself is basically all negative, whether it's phosphorylated or not. It's always negative. So the filament itself has this nice negative surface charge. But then the arms coming out are also very highly negatively charged just as they come out of the packed filament, but as you go farther out, in the dephosphorylated form, they're actually positive. And when you phosphorylate them, then everything is negative. So it leads you to suspect that some of this folding back has to do with these things coming back and folding in on themselves on the right ionic condition. And that can either be, I suppose, low ionic strength to allow this charge to interact, or something else. And the reason it's even plausible to sort of speculate in this kind of crude way is that there is no known secondary structure for this polypeptide. People have tried, and Helene has tried, to measure by circular dichroism if there are alpha helices and beta sheets, and nobody, there's no evidence that there is such a thing. But I'll show you that that's kind of an interesting feature in a moment, because we think we do have folded domains, but we have very little evidence for secondary structure, which is a strange thing. But I'll get to that in a second. So that's what the charge contour looks like. And this is just the evidence that here's a circular dichroism picture of the phosphorylated and dephosphorylated forms of the sidearms. And there's a hint that there's a little bit of alpha helix somewhere, but not very much. If this was really a highly structured protein, we'd have a much prettier signature. So that's where we're at the moment. So we're a little confused by how much charge there is or isn't. So,
the previous thought we should charge that to get that.
Yeah. This one.
The most remarkable thing about the portfolio is that it's extraordinary to get everything not charged.
Yeah.
Has anyone commented on
that? I don't think so.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It may actually be very nice to model this and to see what kind of, you know, as we play with this charge density, how far away this trumpety-like structure would come out of this filament. The other thing, but and it's also, you know, it's coming out of a structure that itself is pretty negatively charged as well. Yeah. Yeah, you know, we've been trying to do that, but all the methods, we've been trying a lot to do that by neutron scattering, and we see remarkably little difference. And it could just be that there's so little of the mass is out in this part that's moving. So we would have to do something like, I'm not quite sure what we'd have to do, either electron micrographs, which are terribly nasty. Atomic force micrographs also are not helping us, because I think we're just so biased by the dense cylinder. So the crudest thing that I've been thinking we should try is that it turns out that the way you prepare these things is by ultracentrifuging the filaments out of a solution. And one of the things people have noticed for decades of purifying neurofilaments is that no matter how hard you centrifuge them, you can never compress them down into a dry pellet. So if you do this, if you purify actin or microtubules, if you centrifuge at 100,000 times G, you get this very nice pellet, and I think Jay Tang has probably showed you some of this. So you can make hundreds of milligrams per mil of actin in these tectoid little structures by centrifugation. And if you centrifuge neurofilaments just as hard, you can never get them to be more than 10 milligrams per mil. So it's possible that if that is dictated by how charged and expanded these arms are, that if we did something really crude, like just weighed how big the pellets are for at different pHs, we may get something indirect but quantitative that we're failing by doing more, more high-tech scattering experiments. And we've been dreaming up ways that we could deuterate these chains and stuff, and you know, it's not happening. So
all the cell,
yeah, I wish I had this image. If we prepare them from the biochemical preps are from a whole spinal cord, which includes, you know, small neurons, big neurons, and different parts of the axon. So most of the neurofilament heavy and medium chains where this phosphorylation happens, most of them are phosphorylated nearly maximally. But it depends very much on the age of the animal. From a baby animal, they're very unphosphorylated. And during development, you get more and more phosphorylated. And people know this because there are antibodies that recognize only phosphorylated epitopes and non-phosphorylated epitopes. And the image I wanted to show you is this beautiful thing from Tony Brown's lab in Ohio, where they use these antibodies to stain a single axon, like one of those cells I showed you at the beginning that's maybe 100 microns long. You can look at different, you know, 10 micron big chunks and ask, is it phosphorylated or unphosphorylated? And it's really beautiful. As you come out of the cell body, the neurofilaments start out unphosphorylated. And as you get out farther and farther out the axon, they become all phosphorylated. So the cell is tuning this phosphorylation during development very tightly, and there are all kinds of neuropathies, things or even Alzheimer's disease. You see this, but it may be an epiphenomenon. But there's all kinds of age-related changes in phosphorylation, and that if you get the neurofilaments phosphorylated too much too early, too much in the central part of the filament, they never can move down the axon. So people are very interested in this. But so the cell is doing something to control it. But the reason for that has been obscure, because there is no obvious change in the neurofilaments. They still assemble. It's not like, you know, they bind to everything more or less. But so from the things we've been looking at, they start out pretty phosphorylated, and we can enzymatically dephosphorylate them. But it is true that in the beginning part of the neuron, or of the axon that comes out of the cell body, they'll have the charge contour looks like this. In the very tip, I'm sorry, the other way around, they'll have a charge contour looks like this. In the tip, they're all negative. To get some idea of the structure, so Philippe and Dennis Discher started to do atomic force microscopy on these things, because in principle they're nice objects to pull on, because they're pretty long and they're semi-flexible, and it would immediately tell us if there are folded domains in these isolated sidearms, or are they just unstructured polypeptides. At least that's what we thought. And there's no prediction that there should be folded domains, but I suppose everybody assumes that there must be. But there are quite a few proteins, all microtubule-associated protein 2, all these MAP2 variants, as well as tau protein. If you look at their secondary structure by some scattering spectroscopic method, they give no evidence of any secondary structure. But they have some kind of folded structure. They're not just, you know, Gaussian coils. They have some kind of folded structure. But there's no alpha helix, there's no beta sheet that anybody can see. And it's possible that these are in the same area. So anyway, Santa Barbara is probably the last place in the world to give an introduction to how AFM works. But basically, you know, we're pulling on the end of a polypeptide, and we're asking, from looking at the force extension curves that the cantilever reports, are we pulling on something that's just uniformly, you know, spread on the surface, or are we pulling on things that have little folded domains that we can pop open as the force is applied? So the expectation is, if we just have something that's a single polypeptide, like pulling on DNA at low extensions or polysaccharides, that it should look like this. And if we pull on something that has folded domains, we should get something like one of these sawtooth patterns. So what we get are pretty nice sawtooth patterns. We've tried three conditions. There's been a hypothesis that some of this structure of the neurofilament might depend on binding of ATP to the sidearms. So we just checked that. So we looked at the, this is again force extension curves for single molecule traces. This force is 50 piconewtons. In the phosphorylated case, either no ATP or ATP, I'll show you in a minute, we get basically the same kinds of features. However, if we take dephosphorylated sidearms, two things happen. We get still sawtooth patterns, and I'll show you that we get basically the same number of teeth, but the forces of unfolding the domains are much smaller by about a factor of 2. So the interpretation is that every one of these, well, not every one, but except for the first and last such tooth, the presence of this kind of highly increasing force extension curve happens from pulling out the slack of some sort of polypeptide, and then all of a sudden the force goes down. That happens because we've now pulled one of these beads so tightly that the hydrogen bonds and whatnot that holds the folded domain let loose, and this thing in a cooperative way just sort of falls apart. Well, we see a bunch, analyzing hundreds or thousands of these things tells us this, that we see generally 6 teeth. You can throw away the first one and the last one for basically experimental features. And it predicts that this polypeptide coming out of the heavy chain has 4 folded domains in it. And the number of folded domains is basically the same, whether we have ATP or not, or whether it's phosphorylated or not. So under all cases, we seem to have 4 folded domains. Yeah. The first peak is usually getting a tip of it to come off the surface at all. that's, I think that, I guess that's the interpretation of these things, that the first peak is just, you know, getting the thing to pull up. And now you start pulling on polypeptide rather than polypeptide to mica or glass surface.
So if every one of these things had four domains, wouldn't you expect a single peak of four? I'm trying to understand the meaning of
this. Ah.
Wouldn't I always see four peaks? Would you give just a peak, you know, a large amplitude of four?
Oh, peaks? No, it depends on where you pick it up. The reason you don't always see four peaks is if you... if you picked it up here and started to pull, you'd throw away this first peak because that's probably yanking this off a surface, so you would ignore that, and you would just pull out this one and this one, for example. If you picked it up at the end, you'd get all three of them. If you picked it up here and this part seemed to detach, but you only pulled out one, you might just get one. So I think that's that's kind of the, I mean, that's certainly the lore of, I mean, that's people's experience that seems to work. And here, it's hard for us to know because this is actually an unusual case. We have no idea how many folded domains to expect, so we're looking. Usually, and all those beautiful experiments that Fernandez and Gaub did, you pull on something that you know how many things to expect. You engineer folded domains in, and then you pull and you see, do I get the right number or not? So that's kind of established the way of thinking about this, and this is a pretty rare instance of taking something whose structure we know nothing about and trying to count up how many domains there might be.
The energies are very close.
That's something I've never said. You very rarely get that. You get that occasionally. So occasionally you get... In forces, the resolution is probably, you know, a couple piconewtons. So occasionally you get things like this, that you pull a lot, and then probably two domains, you know, pull out, maybe. So sometimes you get things like that, but less often than not. And usually the energies of unfolding are even a little bit different for different domains, that one pops and the other one doesn't. Yeah. Yeah. This occasionally you get junk, but often the first peak. Yeah. Man, the first peak is often the biggest one because that's the detaching from the surface one. But occasionally you get this stuff. I have no idea. Yeah. Yeah. And we are pulling very slowly on these things, so it's possible something is restructuring. Constant rate. But it's almost constant force because it's not very. Yeah. Yeah. Not quite constant force. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's an interesting point because we have really no.
You're putting in one there, you're putting parallel in one, and then it pops, and then you're putting anti-parallel. You can actually.
Yes.
Another possibility is you're pulling domains off of surface, so you're seeing different sticky bits.
That's possible.
And then you don't have a correlation between the first one and the last one.
It seems
near the surface that might be the most likely.
That is an interesting point. I think the feature we've used to sort of reassure or suggest that's not what's going on, or at least is you know, it's a result that's consistent with what we imagine is going on, which is that we know what the fully unfolded polypeptide length should be. It should be about 224 nanometers. We know from dynamic light scattering what the folded radius, or the hydrodynamic radius of the folded thing is, which is about 80 or 100 nanometers. So we have something like 100, 120 nanometers we should be pulling out of this from the folded domains. So if you add up all of the peaks and look at how much the total unfolding length is when we pop everything, that number ought to be someplace in this sort of 100 nanometer range. If it was, you know, way off, if it was a couple of nanometers, then we'd be doing something, you know, much different. Or if it was way too long, we'd be looking at oligomers or something like that. So
it's
you right. Yes, we have no way of telling. Yeah, did we just pull off? Yeah, like popping. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
When there's a possibility of several different unfolding.
Yeah.
And you can actually select one group or the other, depending on the route.
Yeah.
So you can actually get rather
paranoid looking at holding. Yeah. No, it's an interesting thing. Yeah. Yeah. We've varied the rate only about a factor of 10 or 20. And, you know, you get bigger unfolding forces at bigger rates, but the number, the distances and the numbers of pops seem to be similar. At least that's where we are, and so what we've been very interested in is this finding. So again, if we're looking at the either the unfolded length of the single domain now, so each domain when it pops gives us about 20 nanometers of polypeptide that was hidden in that domain. So this unfolding length is not so different from the three conditions we've looked at, either phosphorylated things, plus or minus ATP, or dephosphorylated things. But what it is different is the force that it takes to unfold a domain. So if it's phosphorylated, it's harder to pop them open. When they're dephosphorylated, they're easier to pop open. And we don't really have any explanation for why this should be. And so I had, about 6 months ago, I was hoping to get Dave Tirumalai to try to model some of these things, because we can hope to make some sort of molecular model for what these polypeptides should look like, but we can't do it really in molecular dynamics. And we have to do it in some kind of rigid body polypeptide thing. And we have all this complication of putting in these phosphate groups, and we don't know how many and where to put them. So it's a calculating problem. But it seems like something that's now that we see this, I'm really kind of, you know, enthusiastic about trying to invest someone else's time to do it. So, not very much. We were thinking that changing the ATP concentration does actually change the ionic strength quite a bit, because we're putting in several millimolar ATP and it's got such a high charge. So that's the only thing we varied a little bit. We haven't played with other ions at all yet, but we, you know, we may. This unfortunately is a time-consuming experiment. It's the other way around. Yeah, that's been confusing. So it's as though phosphorylation. But it does correlate with the sort of general finding that phosphorylated filaments are stickier to each other than dephosphorylated filaments. So there's something that stabilizes some kind of protein-protein interaction that we don't get from just scanning the charge contour. That's one reason why I think we won't be able to escape modeling or doing something. So let me just skip this and show you. I should stop. I just want to show you two things about a couple of things on counter ions. Is that okay? Sorry. Okay. One is this rather old finding that we can, if we look at light scattering intensity as a measure of bundling. This is Jay Tang's work. Neurofilaments are tremendously good at being bundled by polyvalent cations, and that when the surface charge on the polymer is bigger, it takes more counter ion to get them to collapse into bundles. So this we knew several years ago, that we could make bundles form with hexamers of lysine, for example. But what's kind of potentially more interesting is we can take a polylysine is not a good, there's no physiologic interest in it, but there is in the neuron, and most cell types, there are millimolar concentrations of spermine, which has a +4 charge. And neuronal cells are actually fairly high in spermine concentration. And spermine is much more effective than I would have guessed at. It's less effective than the sixmer of lysine, but it's still quite effective. And because it's a simple molecule, you can make tens of millimolar concentrations of this stuff. So again, if we look at sort of hundreds of micromolar concentrations of spermine, we get this very nice bundling transition looking at light scattering. But if we keep, and we get bigger bundles to form when the filaments are phosphorylated than dephosphorylated. But what's interesting is we keep trucking up on the spermine concentration, all the filament bundles fall apart again. And they fall apart, so this is an experiment we couldn't do with other multivalent counterions because we couldn't go high enough in concentration to get this to happen unless we did something that also denatured the filaments. And we're worried that this thing has to do with denaturation, but it's not because if you dilute out the sample again, it'll form another filament bundle. And this. I think it is resolubilization. Of which kind of bundles? I think it is. I think it is. That's all it is. I think that's all it is. And it may be physiologically interesting because this concentration, this is the concentration of spermine in the cell, or at least it's the concentration. The chemical activity could be, a couple factors different. But we're sitting in a kind of an interesting range of polyvalent counterions. So again, this is something that could tune the volume, the effective volume of these filaments, or the way they interact with each other or with other things. And this is also, and this self-aggregation resides in these sidearms. So again, if we take phosphorylated sidearms and add in this case, spermine, we get the same kind of self-aggregation of the sidearms themselves. So there are two things going on. One is that there seems to be a self-interaction between the sidearms that's counterion dependent, and plus there may be this longer range kind of filament-filament collapse that's also counterion dependent. And those two things in the context of a neurofilament are kind of hard to work out. And here's the sort of the slightly depressing thing is that we've used neutron scattering to try to look at the change in the diameter of neurofilaments that have been condensed with spermine or not, hoping that we could see the sidearms kind of collapse in on the body and now make the filament diameter bigger. And with an experimental error, everything looks pretty much the same. So we're not doing anything to the solid mass that we're looking at by neutrons. We're doing something basically to change the kind of the longer range hydrated volume appearance of the neurofilaments. And that's the hardcore diameter. We were hoping that we could get the hardcore to be bigger if we took the sidearms and collapsed them now onto the core, and we don't see that. So they may be collapsing, but they're collapsing in a more subtle, or they're folding back in a more subtle way. And we can fluorescently label these guys and look at them, and what you see, again now going through this range of spermine concentrations, is in the intermediate range where we're getting filaments bundled. If we take these things and dilute them, we see a lot of tangled up filaments. If we now increase the spermine concentration, we get nice single neurofilaments that look like they did in the absence of spermine. If we tried this experiment with actin, it wouldn't work because the spermine would, at high concentrations, starts to depolymerize the actin. Well, glad you bring this up. So that's one of my big hopes for here is to get Fred to look at these images. So neurofilaments are also, I think, even a more rich system than actin filaments to look at sort of self-interaction of semi-flexible coils, because we can take now sort of counterion concentrations before we get this big collapse and look, and we know that the sidearms are sort of slightly sticky to each other. And you see a lot of coiled structures. This case, these are fluorescently labeled on a glass surface, but we see them also by AFM. And there's a predominance of three or four different kinds of structures. There's a lot of linear polymers. And there are occasional circles. I'm not sure if there's a real good circle in this one, but there will be later. But there are quite a few of these lassos. And these are very common. And surprisingly common until and there are also quite a few of these Y-shaped branch structures, which probably are two things folding over each other. So again, there's another one of these little triskelion-like things. There's a lot of these loops, and let me pop through some of these things. We can always look over these in more detail. But one of the things we'd now have to try start doing is quantifying how many of each of these characters we have and see which chemical conditions drive this. What we do know is that upping the magnesium concentration, for example, gives us a lot more of these looped structures, which is what we'd expect from what actin filaments did. And the loops, again, are now probably an order of magnitude smaller than they are for actin. So the curvature of these loops is somewhere on the sort of micron scale. And they seem to be, well, not exactly uniform, but the diameters might be quite close. So here we can look at this stuff a little bit better in AFM. And so I forget which one we'll focus on, but we see a lot of these closed loop structures. And what's interesting is that they are not usually, they may start by a filament falling over on itself, but then it often wiggles to this place where one end is now on the side of the filament. And it's, those things stay there for a while. They seem to stay there. And let me skip over this and show you, I think, a zoom. Okay, so what we're going to do is zoom in on, or take multiple passes of the AFM and look at this place. So this is quite kind of nice because you can tell from the height contour that these things are about 14 nanometers in apparent height from the AFM tip. And the place where they stick is bigger. And it's not twice as big. And if we take multiple passes at higher resolution, start to look at what this kind of node looks like. It's sort of a nice smeared together mess of mass. It's clearly not an end to a side, nor is it just two things that have overlapped. And there's very, very often places where you don't see anything going over here. It just sort of smoothly ends. Nor is this two filaments and this and these each one. This is just ended there. This is phosphorylated, yes. And phosphorylated with about 5 millimolar magnesium. So we don't know how these structures are forming, but we suspect that they must be sidearm mediated, and there are a variety of ways that they can form, which I hope we can work out with with your help of trying to see how we can quantify that. Here's just a pretty picture of a microtubule. This also shows you how the difference in stiffness. Here's a single microtubule that's now mixed in with some neurofilaments, and they just sort of gently collapse on the contour of the microtubule. I'll skip this except to show you it's a demonstration we do get charge reversal, that the neurofilaments in the presence of spermine at this redissolution concentration migrate to the minus, what is that? That's the anode. No, the cathode. So in the absence of spermine, the things are highly negatively charged. They'll go to the positive pole. In the presence of spermine, the fluorescently labeled things will go to the minus pole. And the last thing I want to show you is that we've just started to look at this, at how these filaments curl around oppositely charged beads. And this may be important physiologically because one of the roles of neurofilaments in the axon is that they wrap around vesicles, and especially mitochondria, and they are thought to sort of trap mitochondria in different places of the cell. Mitochondria have a diameter of about 500 nanometers, and we're beginning to look at how the neurofilaments interact with the mitochondria and whether they simply dock on the side or drape themselves over. And what Oliver has seen mostly is if you take a relatively big positively charged bead, in this case a couple hundred nanometers, they collect, so the beads themselves, we're looking at the fluorescence of the coming from the neurofilament, not the bead. there's a lot of attachment of beads. Single beads will collect many neurofilaments that sort of seem to sort of drape over their surfaces. If we take very small beads, or actually not that much smaller, 10 times or half as big, 100 micron sized beads, we get little aggregates of beads every once in a while, but we also get fairly significantly often linear arrays of beads as though they are now decorating a single neurofilament. And when we get down to very small beads, 20 nanometers, where we can really only see them clearly, do I see this at all here? Where we see them mostly only well by atomic force microscopy, here we can see a single filament that's just decorated with multiple little beads. So we are looking at how we can tune this. What size of bead does it take to wrap around as opposed to be decorated by, and whether we can change this thing by changing the strength of the electrostatic attraction between these two particles. And the hope is that if we understand this thing, you know, physically, we can get some idea of whether what you see in the axon is just simply electrostatically driven or is actually driven by some specific protein-protein interaction. Okay, I better stop there. Yes. Yeah.
In other words, about 100 nanometers between 100 nanometers between filaments.
Yeah.
Which is consistent also with the roughest size domain. That's a pretty crowded environment though for the transport of accessible up and down the hydrogen.
Yeah. There doesn't seem to be an organization about the microtubules. The microtubules actually do seem to be surrounded by neurofilaments, not by each other. And it's one of the cartoons that crashed on my computer was also a cartoon or based on electron micrograph of what the mitochondrion or a vesicle actually sees when it's getting pushed down an axon. So it's clearly something that's 100 nanometers or a couple hundred nanometers in size, which is bigger than a transport vesicle, but the size of a mitochondrion. That thing, if it's moving down a microtubule, which it clearly is surrounded by tens or hundreds of neurofilaments, all of which make contact with it. But the motor is, so those contacts must be very weak or dynamic or cooperatively broken, because the motor molecules can drive it through that meshwork as though it had a viscosity of, you know, maybe 10 centipoise or 20 centipoise at the most. But what happens is that movement is sort of saltatory, and there is some kind of regulated binding. So what we see with mitochondria, for example, is that mitochondria, when they're in a state where they don't have to respire, where they don't need to be making ATP, they don't bind very well to neurofilaments. They kind of, you know, sterically hit them. But when they get to a place where the ATP levels are low, they stick much better to neurofilaments. So it's one of the models of how you stop transport at a certain place is you engage an interaction with this meshwork around it. And that now becomes strong enough so you pull it off the motor. But usually the motor is providing so much force that it can break all of those weak interactions between the filament and whatever cargo the microtubule is carrying. At least that's sort of the rationalization. That's certainly what people see. You can even look at the movement of neurofilaments themselves are carried down the axon along a microtubule. And they're beautiful images of a single fluorescent neurofilament being transported down an intact axon on the back of a microtubule. And the way they move very, very slowly. They move, you know, 1,000 times slower than an unloaded kinesin rate. But it's not like you're driving it through a very viscous medium. What happens is that it moves at a completely unloaded rate for short periods of time, and then it stops and gets trapped. Then it sits there for a while till it gets enough force to detach something, and then it goes ripping again for a while. So that seems to be what a lot of this transport looks like. But it's not, so it...
But
Yes, it would be similar for transport vesicles. So there's some evidence actually from I forget who's in lab, Gelfand maybe, in these melana sites that fish have, that transport of, these things are also coming up and down actin filaments, but the way that they're knocked off, I mean, they come up and down microtubules, but the way their movement is stopped is not that you inactivate the motor, but you activate their attraction to actin, and then the actin meshwork rips them off of the tracks. Oh, that's interesting. The networks are phosphorylated. And the more phosphorylated, the better. Well, hard to say. Yeah. So, in fact, that's actually something I'd love to get your insight on. That's something we've been struggling with. For actin, you can get both the magnitude and the strain at which hardening happens to sort of come out in a worm-like chain model if you knew what the network connectivity was. And with intermediate filaments, so we know the distance between crosslinks, and we know how many elastic elements we have. What we don't know is, in any good detail, is what the geometry of these networks is. And if we just take an orthogonal network and do some really crude estimation, you can get the experimental data are pretty reasonable. But if we get if we have a random network, triangular rather than tetrafunctional crosslinks, we could get a very different connectivity. And that's the thing that's been limiting us from really taking any kind of arbitrary force extension curve for a single polymer and trying to explain the macroscopic elasticity. So that's one of the things that Storm has been working on, but it's been from an outsider like me, it's been a deceptively nasty problem. I thought it would be easy, but it ain't. But you're right that intermediate filaments have this extra complication that things in the molecules themselves seem to change conformation when you pull on them. With actin, or microtubules, it's hard to imagine that happens. With these guys, something is going on.
Sorry, you have to some extent, in these orthogonal models you're talking about, you put that in, and you put the contribution of adding an extra component has to be subdomain.
Yeah.
Break up into
non-domain. No, we have not done that. No, no. This is, yeah. Yeah. You're right. So that's.
It'll change the connectivity. It'll affect the connectivity.
Yeah.
But it's not clear how that couples directly.
Yeah.
Well, unless the side chains are actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
possible. That's possible. The other thing we have not done experimentally, but one of the reasons we started playing with these beads was that we have been hoping to do force extension curves of a single neurofilament, and that's been nasty. You can't do it like you can do it with DNA because there are no good chemical linkers to bond to the two ends. So we're hoping just to sprinkle beads on them and take the occasional thing that has a bead on two ends and optically trap that. So we don't know anything really about the nonlinear force extension of a single neurofilament yet. All we know is persistence length and macroscopic stuff. I think it doesn't change very much. And at least the reason for that is that if we look at phosphorylated and dephosphorylated filaments, at least on these AFM grids, the visual image is that the dephosphorylated ones might be a little bit more flexible, but not very much. And we're just beginning now to try to quantify all this stuff and see if we can get some crude estimate of that. But that doesn't change remarkably. And another evidence for that is that the persistence length of neurofilaments is almost the same as the persistence length of vimentin filaments or keratin filaments, which don't have these sidearms. So they're not changing the measurable persistence length that we've been able to look at.
So one possibility could be that there are some water channels in the neural filaments and then, for instance, change the hydration. If you look into this, when you compare the hydrogen to the other system, whether it's fully hydrated or do you
think there is some. Nobody's got this. I think nobody's looked into this. That's a really interesting idea. It is pretty clear that the axon environment is just, you know, barely hydrated enough. I mean, if you think of those neurofilament sidearms as acting like polyethylene glycol or something, then they're going to, who knows what the water activity is in the axon. It could be, you know, tremendously different from bulk water. So, yeah, all these kinds of, I think, possibilities of these water channels are, I think they're just not explored.
And then you have the mice,
which
knocked out
using
the
filaments. Yeah. No, it is. It's, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's one of those things that there are neurofilament minus mice that are alive and happy, and they don't seem to have any neurodegeneration. Their axons are different, so what they have instead of 15 microtubules and 100 neurofilaments, they have 115 microtubules in them. So they compensate for the lack of neurofilaments by putting in more microtubules, but the argument has been that a mouse is not going to have. Should I say this, that there is a very mild phenotype in the mouse if it doesn't have neurofilaments. If it has sort of hyper-sticky neurofilaments, that it builds and assembles, but they make a meshwork that's too tight, that's very bad for the mouse. That gives them a neurodegenerative disease that looks like a lot of human neuropathies. Apparently, except that, yeah, transport in the mouse is more or less okay, but there is a larger animals is a quail, for example, is there's a naturally found mutation in a quail that has a kind of a tremoring defect. So quail's a big bird, like it's, you know, this big. I don't know. It's kind of, you know, 100 times bigger than a mouse, and they have a very bad neuronal phenotype, and their disease is caused by a mutation in the in one of these sidearms of the neurofilaments. So they do not make neurofilaments, and they're tremendously neurologically messed up. And the argument has been that this is a scale-dependent thing, that you can get away with axonal, if your axon is only a centimeter big, then you don't need to have this kind of extra volume-filling stuff. But if the bigger you get, so if people made transgenic giraffes, that they would have, you know, they would have much bigger problem. And I think that's a big argument in mouse transgenics anyway, that you don't look at anything except things that are like really necessary for embryonic development or something.
But do you see a huge correlation in spine length
You see a big, well, I don't know. I'm not sure if that's really evolutionarily, you know, right. I don't know. You do see very big sequence differences between small animals and big animals. And you see, yes. Ah, there's a good thought. Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. We've actually just now been, that's a really key point. We've been working with a with Erica Holzbauer, who's a biologist at Penn, and she has a mutation not in the neurofilament, but in the motor molecule dynein that's necessary to transfer part of the complex, not the dynein itself, but the linker molecule that allows neurofilaments to be moved out of the axon. And those animals, they make neurofilaments, but they're not distributed down the axon. They're kind of inappropriately packed elsewhere. And those animals are okay until they get to be about 4 or 5 months old. And then they become very neurodegenerated in a way that looks very much like aging. And I think this is a pretty key feature that if you have a mutation in something that decreases your lifespan by 10 years, that's evolutionarily horrible, but you would never see it during, you know, if you just studied, you know, young animals, right? So it's not, so I think it's, it may be, you know, all this stuff may be biologically really important, but just not for early development.
Thanks. Okay.